Let me just, I have no idea what the rhythm here of these little breakout sessions is to be. So they asked me to address a topic. So I've got some thoughts on idolatry. It's a topic relatively close to all of our hearts, but especially to mine. I'm just finishing up a manuscript on it. And because part of the reflections that I was offering last night and in the conversations and the circles I live in, idolatry has become, it's been rehabilitated as a tool, a useful tool. 100 years ago, the great secular prophets of the 19th century would have used the language of idolatry against the church. The church wasn't, that wasn't the lingua franca of the church. Idolatry was the language of cultural accommodation, cultural compromise that religion, especially across Europe, had effectively borrowed all of its goodwill from the wider culture and used it for its own purpose, that they had made God now in their own image to establish and conserve their own power. Now, interestingly, the most interesting reflections on idolatry in the last 20 years clearly are the post-Holocaust Jewish reflections. Literature that most of us don't live in, but it's obviously in the part of the canon where you find the most reflections on idolatry are in the prophets. And so Jewish reflection on idolatry has been vital and vibrant. Evangelicals, interestingly, have been Johnny-come-lately to the conversation about idolatry, but not insignificantly. So Keller's Counterfeit Idols, Greg Beale's We Are What We Worship. There's a host of volumes that are made it more interesting. And so I want to just put it in the context of cultural engagement. I think that's what Keller's up to, actually, in this language of counterfeit idols. That's where that sermon series emerged from. And so, and I want to do it in a peculiar way, and I'll do it relatively briefly, and then we can talk about anything you're interested in or whatever. I want to put it against the backdrop of the Imago Dei. We're talking about Imago Dei a little bit today. The Imago Dei is the mirror image of an idol, or we could probably rightly say the opposite. The same Hebrew term, selem, that we have for image, is used after Genesis 9 exclusively to refer to an idol. Now, there are a host of terms that the Old Testament uses for idols, depending on what the idol is made of, wood, stone, whatever, painting. And so, but the dynamic, the theological dynamic of being an image bearer is remarkably similar to the dynamic, the theological dynamic of idolatry. And that's why I think it's an enduring construct for us as Christians as we think about our engagement with the wider world. So my claim is, as many others, that the crisis of human identity that we've inherited for the last century or more, the crisis of who are we, is the crisis of significance and of security. Right? It's something you frame in a different number of ways. Are we important? Is there dignity? Is another way to attach to that question. And is there safety? How do we deal with fear, anxieties, the like? And I think that those continue on in the middle of affluence and without affluence, that they're not economically modulated. We frame it differently in different socioeconomic contexts, but the questions of significance and of safety endure across all our economic context. And in part because I think they're rooted in our hardwiring. That's where God makes us. We yearn for significance, we yearn for safety. And so the questions as anthropologists, theological anthropologists, have raised the question, who or what are we? A host of different ways we answer that question in ordinary discourse. Mostly, we answer it by what we do. We frame our identity, both significance as well as safety, in terms of vocation, in terms of jobs, in terms of tasks. You walk into a room, 90% of the time, you will introduce yourself by what you do. There's nothing wrong. That's one way to frame your identity. That is one way to frame your significance and your safety. You could surely frame it by your ethnic community, as many traditional societies would. I'm a member of the, you know, such and such a tribe or such and such a family. That's another way to frame significance and security. 400 years ago in the European context, your identity would have been attached to your parents. I'm the son of. Often that's actually how your name came to be. A whole host of ways to frame that. Philosophers talk about our identity being the connection between mind and body, or you think about a neurobiological structure. Questions about our significance, however, require something more than, so the biblical claim is, something more than mere description of our humanness. They require something outside of ourselves, a commitment to a wider community, a commitment to a wider task, or, as I think Genesis reminds us, to a God who made us. I made that claim last night that I think Genesis 1 is a priestly text, the temple text. And most of the form critical as well as recent evangelical commentaries on Genesis have brought that to pass. Our early Jewish Midrash on Genesis 1 almost always thought of it as a temple text, that is, as God creating a template that would serve as a footprint for the temple, the outer, the inner court, the Holy of Holies. You have a three-tiered universe, the heavens, the earth, and the waters. You have the liturgies of the rhythm, of the six and the one, which then modulated or regulated worship in the temple. You had all sorts of parallels of filling, that glory was to fill the earth, and almost all the temple building narratives we have in the Old Testament have the notion of God's presence filling the temple. All sorts of other arguments to that effect. John Levinson, the great Hebrew scholar at Harvard, actually has written extensively to this as a Jew, arguing that early Jewish commentary on Genesis 1 was exactly right, that when Philo says, the highest and in the truest sense, the holy temple of God is the whole universe. He's reflecting on Genesis 1, that the whole universe is the temple of God's presence. He's created it as a space for worship. In one sense, pretty obvious to those of us who refer to God as the Lord of the universe, that the whole universe is to be construed not simply as a physical space, but a space for worship. And so if that's right, then the language of image, Salem, the Salem Elohim, the image of God, in that ancient context would refer to the representations of the deity of the temple. That the image of God is the, so to speak, the statue or the idol placed in the temple to designate that space belonging to the deity who was represented by that idol. So a conquering king, also deity, would establish a temple in the conquered lands as indication that he was the lord of those lands and was to be worshipped. And a physical representation of the king or the pharaoh would be placed in that temple, right, and would rule over those lands. That's the same dynamic at work there in Genesis. God has placed his idol, a statue representing his lordship, and that image, that individual is to rule. And this language of kavod is a real military, ancient military term. Is to rule, to be keep the land ordered as the king has determined. Now, the upshot here is that I think wired into the way the Bible speaks of image is that we are reflections of God as representation. We are to do that which God would do in his kingdom. Again, I hope not entirely odd. But what's interesting in my way of thinking is that after Genesis 9, the language of Salem, image, is never used again positively in the Old Testament canon. It drops out. Theologians who have talked about it in the last 50 years have actually argued that the history of Christian theology that has made so much of the image of God as the primary category to think about human identity must be mistaken, since it is used so infrequently in the Bible. Between Genesis 9, the end of the flood narrative, and the reissuing of the new creation mandates, right, the protection of human life, you shall not take life, for it's created in the image of God. That's the last time it then drops out. Now, one of my questions is, why? Why does it drop out? And what comes in its place? Those are interesting clues. That's what an investigator does, I think. A preacher who's working all the way through the canon notices something like this. And so I think here, again, all too quickly, a much longer argument, that what's taking place is God creates the universe, the cosmos, as a temple in which he is to be worshipped, places in that temple, in the cosmos, right at the center, a representative who is to keep order, to rule in God's place, if you will, and abandons that calling and is ushered out of the Holy of Holies, out of the garden. God protects them for a time. But short of returning into God's presence, they are still looking for something to worship and a place to find safety. They are looking for significance and security. This is the human quest. This is the whole origin of the pilgrimage narratives, the journey narratives, the wilderness narratives. We're on the way to finding something. So the promise to Abraham, fast forward just a moment from Genesis 9 over to 12 and then into 15, God promises to protect his people by being with them. So now he's not going to protect them by means of an earthly ruler. He's going to protect them by being present. And so now there is a localized presence of God, and not only a cosmic or universal presence of God made manifest. And it's this localized presence of God that we call the gospel. That's what redemption is, that God comes and is with us. And the promise to Abraham, the covenant with Abraham, is a assurance that God will not abandon his people. So we've moved from the image which seeks after divine safety and significance, as it ought, to now this interim situation where God in the wilderness comes and promises to be with his people. This is the narrative prelude to Yahweh's discussion of idolatry. He has promised to be with them. He has made them, hardwired them to find God. God has instead found them, and the dynamic then continues, and here we land in Exodus 32. You could go a host of places, that what Israel does paradigmatically or typologically is, in the midst of God's presence, nonetheless goes in search for some other significance and safety. That's the challenge throughout Israel's history. So when Moses delivers the commandments there in Exodus 20, before we get to Exodus 32 briefly, you shall have no other gods before me. Kind of an odd way to start, actually, because there aren't any other gods. There is only one God. But God often refers to himself as the living God. He's the only God that's alive. There's lots of dead gods. That's kind of almost a contradiction in terms. But right at the outset, the commandments are communicated as a diatribe against idolatry. So that the monotheism that underlied Israel's existence from Abraham onwards is really not a fundamentally ontological claim, a metaphysical claim. It is that there's only one God in the whole universe. You make a case, depending on your own philosophical intuitions, that there can only be one omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, omnibenevolent God. There can't be more than one. But leaving aside the philosophical arguments there, it's not fundamentally in the commandments an ontological claim. It's a claim about worship. You're to worship no other gods, right? You're to yearn for your significance and your safety nowhere else. So that the second commandment is actually a repetition of the first commandment, not to make any graven images. That is, not to have any other gods, not to suppose that the wood or the tree, the stars, the sun or the moon, or anything else will provide you significance or safety. Quite interesting that right in that constitutional document of the Mosaic period is a prohibition of idolatry. Now, what's a couple of threads from that is that there are as many idols as there are objects in the world. Nobody worships the same deities. This was true in the ancient world. It's true in the modern world. That's what makes idols so interesting, because you can find your significance in so many different places. You can hunt for security in so many different ways. It's true in the ancient world. It's true in the modern world. Henri Blochet, an older book, In the Beginning, I think it's called, University Press, a long time at TEDS and also at Wheaton, French, has commented on this contrast between the image and the idol, drawing attention here. The challenge of being an image is that we are only an image, but we alone are the image. So it exalts as well as humbles. And it's the humility of the image. We are only an image. We are not the original, as he says. We are a mirror that reflects the great and true living God. But a mirror is derivative in its function from that which it reflects. It finds its functional purpose in reflecting. Just a thought experiment. A mirror that's attempting to reflect a mirror. Put them side by side, and if you could somehow superimpose your perception in the middle without getting in the way, what do you see? A mirror mirroring a mirror. Infinite nothingness, as it were. It just goes on, right? You've got to fill it with something for it to function as a mirror. Now, again, not getting too nuanced in the argument here, we are created as mirrors, reflectors, and without the living God, we will find something to reflect, something to worship, something to adore, something to find our significance. That's the dynamic, right? If you will, that the plot simply is turned upside down. We who were created to find our satisfaction in the living God find the chase after idols to replace that original worship. So the paradigm, and maybe I just close here with some initial thoughts, the paradigm episode of idolatry, and it is a paradigm. We have episodes in the canon which serve as large templates for things that happen later that are interpreted in light of. So sprinkled throughout the prophets is a reference to that golden calf, as if Israel's disobedience is like the disobedience of Exodus 32. It's referenced, I think, a half a dozen times in the New Testament as well. It's a paradigm of what idolatry is. But, of course, idolatry is not always worshiping a golden calf. But it's paradigmatic, that it's a template, in the sense that as Israel worships this golden calf, they become like the golden calf. They have ears, but cannot hear. They have eyes, just like the golden calf does, but they cannot see. They have a stiff neck, just like the golden calf does. They have a hard heart. Their description becomes like that which they worship. You become, this is Beale's point, you become like that which you honor. I mean, that's true. In every instance, I mean, that's just an ordinary human phenomena. So nothing superimposed, I think, until you find it actually cosmically created by God to function that way. And when that happens, it strikes me, we are able to raise the question, what will satisfy the human heart? That's a profoundly theological question. It's not fundamentally a psychological question. There's a psychological dynamic there. What will provide safety from your fears? What will provide significance? That's the template that we get going here from Genesis 1 to Exodus 32. The chapter is maybe one of the most interesting chapters in all of Scripture. This wonderful conversation between the Israelites, talking with Aaron, placed in parallel the conversation Moses having with Yahweh. And early on in the chapter, there appears to be some disagreement as to whose people these people are, right? And who brought them up out of the land of Egypt. Israel's claiming to Aaron that the idol has brought them up out of the land of Egypt. Yahweh then refers to them as Moses' people. And Moses then, time out, right? He says to Yahweh, no, these are your people. Right? And I think you make a case that actually what's going on is a test of Moses in this chapter. Though we focus on the golden calf, the question is, will Moses stand with his people or abandon them in their crisis? And so I think it is actually a test of ministry. But that's another point. So they finally make a case that Moses is to enact swift judgment. He's not persuaded at first until he sees it. Then he undergoes this transformation, and 3,000 Israelites are killed that day. But what's so interesting, another interesting point about the chapter, is that Moses somehow, we're not quite sure exactly, kind of melts down this golden calf, smelts it or puts it in the fire, or we're not quite sure exactly, and makes the people drink their idol. He literally makes them become what they thought was going to feed them. This golden calf in the desert was going to care for you, providing food. So let's give it a shot. Let's see if it works, if you will. And so they take the idol to themselves and become like the idol. They look like it. They act like it. They hear like it. They see like it. That is, they become dumb and deaf spiritually. So Moses closes this chapter by telling us that he's gone back up to make atonement with Yahweh. Goes back up the mountain again and says, forgive this people, and if you won't forgive their sins, take my life. Right? The clear, I think, penal substitutionary language there, offering himself as a sacrifice on their behalf. He's tempted by Yahweh's offering to create a whole new nation from Moses. And Moses says, no, these are my people. Right? Take my life in their stead. I mean, you know, in one sense, he passes the test. But Yahweh doesn't accept the substitute. That one's coming for later. So here then is the kind of wider conceptual map of image and idol. That dynamic is at work in all of us. We will yearn for significant, we will worship something. It may not be at an altar where we bring bulls and goats, but we will worship something. It's a different way to do cultural analysis by asking the question, what do we desire? And in this rather transparent time as ours, where desire is the lingua franca of our day, it's a nice conceptual tool that I think the church must use effectively and ask the question, do your idols work? Right? Let's put them to the test. So the great contest of the Baals on Mount Carmel, you know what I mean? Let's try it. Let's give it a shot. Let's see if wealth will satisfy your soul. Right? Let's see if pornography will give you what you think it can deliver, right? Try them out. I mean, there's be careful of my language here, but there's a kind of pragmatism. Let's see if it works. It strikes me that the psalmist declaring taste and see, it is that test, right? Come to the Lord and see if he satisfies your yearning for significance and your yearning for safety. So I think this is a nice template to ask the questions, why do the cultural issues that seem so front and central for us, what do they express about our yearnings for significance, our yearnings for safety, and helping people to think about their own heart's delight is an incredibly important pastoral function. You have. Now, concluding, when Marx or Feuerbach or Nietzsche in the 19th century make this case that Christianity is simply a figment of our imagination, that we've created a God that talks like us, looks like us, actually is on our side. We've created a God for our own benefit. This is what an idol is. That religion has become idolatrous. And religion always has that capacity. That we save ourselves by creating the idol. These very interesting texts in Isaiah 40 to 44, the idol text, they're sometimes called. And maybe no place in all of the Isaiah material is there such deep sarcasm that the prophet uses. That you cut down this tree and you use half of the tree to cook the food. And then with the other half of the tree, you worship it. It's your idol. And you tell that idol that it's provided the food for you that you've cooked with the other half of the log. It's just dripping with sarcasm here. That there is a incoherence to the practice of idolatry. When we create the gods that supposedly have created us. This is the argument Paul's making in Acts 17, quite clearly at Athens. But why do we do it? Because we want a God on our own terms. We want a God whom we control. But we yearn nonetheless still for significance and safety. So we have to have something that fills that void. And not simply one, but often multiple. I think in a time like ours, in deeply embedded social pluralism, as Greg has said several times, so much echoing the cultural landscape of the first century where there are just multiple deities, ours is a time of multiple idols. Are there some dominant ones? Yes, that's the task of pastors. Put your finger on the cultural idols of your people, of your neighborhoods, and expose them, not as a way of bringing down the hammer, but of saying there is actually something that works. There is something that will satisfy your soul. Don't settle for something that won't satisfy. Many of you deal with accountability groups in your churches with men addicted to pornography, right? Pornography is especially destructive. But you know, it's stupid when you think about it. But it's so addictive nonetheless. That's the perplexing thing about idols. They promise great blessing, but they don't deliver on it. And so what do? You go back to the idol again and again, thinking the next time I'll get what I want. That's the psychological dynamic of addiction. It's a theological dynamic of idolatry. Right? We become addicted to our idols because they don't deliver fully on what they promised us. And so we keep going back to them. And I think this is part of the already and the not yet character of our times. Also, that until we see God face to face, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, our hearts are still going to be restless. Woe unto us if we suppose that the problem of idolatry is the problem of people sitting in the pews, not mine. That there are pastoral idols. You have them, I have them. Most of us are in ministry because we like people to listen to us. There are a couple of you that have gone into ministry not because you're needing affirmation, but most of us are here because we need affirmation. And the church is a dreadful place most of the time to get affirmation, right? And so it creates idolatries in us. Maybe they're professional idolatries, if we're just more professional, more credentials, more whatever it might be. Jesus has more harsh things to say about people who get paid for being religious than any other group in the New Testament. And guess what? That's you and me. We get paid for being religious. There is great danger anytime that happens. Anytime you mix money and religion, alarm bells. But we're not the only ones with idols. But we kid ourselves if we don't also show our people that our idols are hard to get rid of, too. Right? I mean, the only one that finally exposes and breaks the hold of idols is God himself. This is the act of the new creation, of cleansing the heart. Of in life, even that interesting language that you have in on the Damascus Road with Paul, right? So that he sees and then is blinded. The light of the gospel is so bright, his eyes no longer can see. And then by the power of the Spirit, he's given his sight again. His, you know, his sensory malfunctioning is healed. We see again. And he's given new hearts, the language of the new heart scattered throughout the New Testament materials. It is, again, idol. Time to...
It's okay. Finish up. Here's what I wanted to say. Transition soon. But the next, after these mini sessions, we'll all meet in the worship center again prior to the breakout, the next breakout session. Okay?
Okay. Thanks, Greg. Sorry, I meant to conclude about 15 minutes ago and chance for comments. So let me just stop there abruptly and see if you get comments.
So, you know, I see, the, you know, for example, don't tell me who I can't marry.
Yep.
In America, we worship liberty. That's
yep.
I see
choice.
Liberty giving me significance.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the safety in liberty?
Yeah, because we can get
is an idol in our culture.
Right, right. The more choices we have, the more power we suppose we have, and the greater the power, the greater the ability to flee from that which threatens us. So I think this is the metastasizing of choice is the dilemma, or shall we say, the idol of our times. Peter Berger has this great illustration about going to the airport and before you lies the possibility of going to anywhere in the whole world today. I mean, it's remarkable the power that you feel by being able to choose where to go. We choose everything. I mean, choice is just wired for us.
Do you think some of our church growth models, we've just figured out how to capitalize on our idolatry?
Right, right. We've tamed the idols a little bit so they aren't so threatening, and so we give them, because choices, I think choice can be a restraint on tyranny. Right, so there's something good about being able to choose. I mean, in one sense, I'm glad, mostly, that I got to choose my wife. I'm not so glad that my children. I'm not so glad my children get to choose their spouse. I'd like to choose them for them, you know, in that regard. But that is democracy, democratization, the kind of metastasizing of choice into all of life and all of culture, has something good. There's an impulse that guards against tyranny, the power of one over another. But the blessing becomes its own curse. How many of us feel paralyzed by the number of choices we have in a day? I mean, as my students feel that all the time. I feel that all the time. It becomes numb. I mean, walk into a grocery store and think how many choices you make.
There used to be only one kind of Oreos.
Right. I always call it the Baskin Robbins of life.
Like that. And when it comes to rotation. We did this a lot in Cuba. We would bring Cubans in. They just can't understand four cans of green beans. It's just not beyond the story.
Right.
So, the question, we're back to Genesis then, and the theme that you're up on in terms of the, and you can see the reversal. So Adam and Eve are looking for significance and safety. Are you carrying that forward and saying that those are legitimate human needs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. They're certainly natural.
Natural.
In
yep.
the sense of the word. One would be hard pressed to
oh,
waste
amen.
Them out of your life.
Yes, exactly.
So, about 20 or 25 years ago, there was a famous, you know, book of the month that lasted most of the year called "The Search for Significance." I have no recollection of who wrote it.
Robert.
But he's, I think, you know, most of the books I comment on, I haven't read. This is one of them that I've not read, but I recall. I do read the back of it.
That's right.
I do read the fly cover. But as I recall, he was arguing against that, saying we should find our significance in Christ, right, not in our jobs,
right,
etc. Comment on that.
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. You'd have to nuance it a little bit more. Be careful with it, because is there something good about finding some satisfaction in your work? Yeah,
well, because
but not ultimate satisfaction.
Because I know when we've all been in the right introductions where, you know, spend 5 minutes, introduce yourself, yep, but don't say a word about what you do.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's a fun game, but it's hard.
It's hard. It is hard. So there are temporal goods, and then there are eternal goods. And so I think you'd have to, you know, talk about those, but we're going to have to talk about it later.
The next seminar started 3-4 minutes ago, and they're going to go till 4:30, and then at that point, if everyone will meet back up in the auditorium for instructions for this, the last one, so it'll change up. So
we are
5 minutes with each other.
So the next seminar is 4:30.